Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for October 2013. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. Rob Reed is an entrepreneur and a writer. As an entrepreneur, he founded Rhapsody, an online music streaming service. As an author, he's written a book called Year Zero. It's all about aliens who illegally download music, and it's a satirical look at the absurdity of the state of copyright damages in the USA. I spoke with Rob from his office in Los Angeles, California. Hi, Rob.
Hey there.
So in 140 words or less, what is Year Zero about?
Year Zero is the story of a vast alien civilization that is so into human pop music that they accidentally commit the biggest copyright infringement since the Big Bang, thereby bankrupting the entire universe.
All right, without giving away too much about it, Landslide, which is the American Bar Association IP magazine, in a summertime review, described Year Zero as making copyright infringement litigation funny, accessible, and entertaining. What is so funny, accessible, and entertaining about copyright litigation?
Well, everything that is accessible and entertaining about genomics, and I say that kind of jokingly. So the way I explain it to people who don't happen to have a background in copyright law or an interest in it is, you know, if you didn't happen to have a background or interest in genomics, you could still enjoy an awful lot of Michael Crichton novels, because although you are in danger of learning a thing or two about genomics if you read Jurassic Park or a couple things like that, a fascination or a background in that is not required to have fun with a book, because it's really in Jurassic Park, you know, the genomics background is really the dynamic that sets the story in motion. And I basically phrase things similarly with Year Zero with respect to copyright law. If a particular reader happens to have no interest or background in copyright law, and let's face it, that's most people out there, they don't need that to approach the book, because it is just the thing that gets the story going. That said, I think there's plenty that's funny and strange and entertaining about copyright law, because it has been such a strange political hot potato over the decades. And one of the things that I sometimes say about American copyright law, and this is also true in many, many other countries, but American copyright law is that which I am most familiar with. Researching it and learning it is kind of like doing archaeology in Greece or Rome. You come up across these layers that were laid down when a particular issue was huge, like, oh, wow, we're in the player piano layer of law, or my goodness, we're in, you know, the rise of radio layer of law. And at every one of these eras, laws were passed generally by fairly powerful, or, you know, under the influence of fairly powerful and well-organized lobbies that just never really went away, and they just kind of accrued on our law books. And as a result of that, there's all kinds of absurdities and contradictions and, you know, sillinesses in the law. And I think that those are, once you've explained them hopefully quickly and accessibly and in a painless way to people who don't have a depth or a background in that area, they are very lampoonable. And I think a lot of humor can result from that.
I read a legally downloaded copy of your book, and I think that you mentioned the word absurd. I think that's an apt descriptor of your book. It seemed to be in the vein of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or Dirk Gently. Was Mr. Adams one of your influences?
Yeah, I think anybody who writes comedic science fiction without any question owes a debt to Douglas Adams, because he really popularized the genre. He wasn't the very first person to write comedic science fiction, but he certainly popularized it. I read his stuff when I was a kid, and I think with any author, the authors that they have read and loved, or even the authors they've read and not loved in the past, all of them collectively certainly have an influence. Another writer that I really loved a lot as a kid and still do, far more obscure, is a writer named Stanislaw Lem. L-E-M as in Mary. He was a Polish writer, and he wrote a lot of his science fiction during the Cold War and so forth. And I don't know how he had the freedom to write as freely as he did. I think he ended up in Berlin at some point, but a lot of what he wrote was veiled criticism of the Soviet system and the Eastern Bloc system. But in general, it wasn't heavily politicized writing. In general, it was just, his work is just incredibly absurdist, brilliantly funny. And what I am intrigued by is the wordplay is magnificent. And I'm intrigued because he generally wrote in Polish. And so that means that the wordplay that he indulged in Polish was somehow translated by, you know, an incredibly gifted translator who cared a great deal to bring the kind of the fun and the whimsy and so forth over into English without, I mean, I assume without losing much in translation. I don't read Polish, but the English was fantastic. So there's are a couple writers that I definitely love and had some influence by.
So in year zero, you don't spare anyone, copyright litigators, record label executives, even U.S. senators who are on the take. Who is the most fun for you to lampoon in your book?
You know, everybody's fun to lampoon, but forced to choose, I would have to say U.S. senators, because, as you know, there was a very, very highly lampoonable U.S. senator, Senator Orrin Hatch, who is the senior Republican from Utah and has in many ways been the lapdog of the media, the big media interests, as they've sought to shape copyright law to their advantage. And I got to know Mr. Hatch, as you know, my background was I founded the company Listen.com that created the Rhapsody Music Service. And back in the early, we were the first music service to be licensed, to get full catalog licenses from all five major labels. And basically Rhapsody was and remains an on-demand streaming service. A much better known analogy to it today is Spotify. Rhapsody really never got itself out of the United States. It's still pretty big in the US with over a million subscribers. But anyway, back when we were building Rhapsody, I spent a fair amount of time in Washington because there was an enormous amount of lobbying that was going on all fronts to try to influence the rules of copyright in the digital age. And I got to know Senator Hatch a little bit, not much, but a little bit. And he's a pretty easy person to lampoon. I mean, like I said, he's kind of been the lapdog of the media interests, and he's been a little bit shameless in how he has kowtowed to them and how he has allowed them to kowtow to him because he fancies himself a songwriter. And every now and then, you know, Hollywood or the RIAA would arrange for somebody to throw him a trivial little bone by excerpting one of his songs in a movie or having, you know, some really well-known singer or songwriter leave him a flattering message. And in exchange for that, there's really no depth to which he will not stoop to please his masters.
Hence the code name Fido in the book?
Yes, and this is not something... So Orrin Hatch is depicted very, very plainly and in fact by name in the book. It's, of course, a work of fiction, and none of the things that he does with aliens actually happen in real life, to my knowledge. But one thing that I did make up is the law firm in the book, which is an incredibly effective and cunning law firm that does a lot of lobbying. They refer to Senator Hatch as Fido because he is the music industry's lapdog. That's sort of their code name for him, a code name that they hope he never learns. Fido is not something that I'm aware of anybody ever calling him in real life. But that's how the lawyers refer to him in the book.
What were you trying to say to the copyright world in year zero?
Well, I guess in general, I would say, and this is something that I've said in, you know, in real life and also through my fiction, at some point, the damages that a government is willing to award a rights holder for the most trivial infraction, copyright infraction or perceived infraction, at some point, those damages can get so preposterous that it ends up badly undermining the interests of the copyright holders and of the copyright industry. And I should point out, as an author with a major publisher, with Random House, I am not a copyright, you know, crazy. I do believe in the importance of intellectual property and the importance of copyright and the importance of creators getting paid. But the situation we have in the United States is any infraction Almost however small. It's a little bit of an exaggeration to say however small, but borderline that. Indeed, if you pirate a single copy of a single song, by American law, you are technically liable for $150,000 in damages. The normal standard for legal retribution in the United States, I believe, is treble damages. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm going out a little bit on a limb here. But if I slander somebody or through my extra legal shenanigans or even something like trademark infringement, which sounds a lot like an IP violation, any one of these things, if I can prove in a court of law that somebody's done me wrong, or they can prove that I've done them wrong, the normal standard is triple damages. Now, with an MP3 typically selling for 99 cents, this is 150,000 times damages. And the law is so absurd on its face that when people hear about it and they start to understand that, you know, using a file sharing service can literally bankrupt them if they, you know, put a dozen songs up there, it's really hard to respect that law. And it's really hard to respect the industry that caused it to be brought into law. And it becomes over time, as we start undermining the notion of the sanctity of law, you start really eroding a notion of the sanctity of copyright, because it is so plainly absurd. And so I think that that is one case in which rights holders, in lobbying the U.S. government very successfully, got very, very badly carried away to their own detriment by having this preposterous damage get on the books. And it is, you know, many tens of thousands of lawsuits have been filed under this law. And I think it's lunacy, and I think it damages the interests of rights holders like myself.
You did a TED talk a year or two ago called the $8 billion iPod, where yes, you talk about copyright math. How does an iPod become that expensive?
Well, it's basically derived from this very law. So if you look at the capacity of the largest iPod on the market, it's funny, my mouth wants to say iPad when I say iPod, because iPods are so much not part of our world anymore. But nonetheless, they were kind of part of our world a year ago when I gave this TED talk a year and a half ago. The biggest iPod on the market, at least then when I gave the talk, was 160 gigabytes. And so if you do the math, you figure there's 3 minutes per song on average. That 160 gigs gives you room for about 52,000 something songs. And if you say, I'm going to fill up this iPod with only strictly pirated music, the $150,000 liability for each one of those 52,000 plus something songs, you do the math and it comes out to $8 billion in liability. Now, clearly on the face, that's an insane notion that an iPod could have $8 billion worth of liability contained on it. And that was just sort of an absurdist calculation to, again, point to the fact that at its root, this law has absolutely no grounding in reality. And it was fun. The TED talk is called Copyright Math. It's pretty quick. I think it was like 5 or 6 minutes. And it was obviously meant to be absurdist and comedic, but also to make that point.
I'll be providing a link to that TED talk in the podcast. So if people want to hear that and see it, they can. I suggest they do. But let's come back to year zero. So what's next for year zero?
Actually, I will share a smidgen of news, and unfortunately, I can't say anything beyond just the statement of fact, but we have signed a movie deal.
Ooh.
And that's about as much as I can say. Now, the fact is, the vast, vast, vast overwhelming majority of books that do sign movie deals of some kind or nature, the movie is never made. It's just ordinarily it's dabbling. It's just simply an option on the part of the producer or the studio. In this case, it's a much, much more serious than average thing. So I'd say the odds of a movie actually being made are still certainly less than 50%, because the odds of any movie being made until it goes into production are always less than 50%. But they're quite a bit higher than they are normally when a book just gets to first base, let's say, with Hollywood. And I'm hopefully going to be able to talk about this in some detail some point in the next several weeks to couple of months. But for now, I'm not supposed to really say anything more than what I just said.
Well,
but
hopefully
there will be a movie. Thank you very kindly.
I'd heard that George Clooney and Sandra Bullock were looking for a new property. So
they've been brawling over this one. It's been ugly.
Now, in terms of your writing, I understand from your bio on Wikipedia that you wrote a book called Year One, which was about first year Harvard Business School.
I did.
You've now written Year Zero. Yep. Am I seeing a progression here that your next one is going to be either Year Minus One, or what are your next plans in terms of writing?
Well, negative numbers would be tricky, but it certainly occurred to me. So I'll give you a little bit of background. My first book is called Year One. I wrote it almost 20 years ago, and it's basically a chronicle of what the first year at Harvard Business School is like, which is something that I was an expert in at the time because I was a first year. And because you have a legal audience, I will candidly admit that it was a naked homage to Scott Turow's first book, which was called 1L, about the first year at Harvard Law. And so I wrote that when I was a first year in business school because in addition to being very interested in business, I wanted to write. And I wanted to write off and on and hopefully more on than off for the rest of my life. So I wrote a couple of business books. And then I got this idea that I wanted to write a novel. And I came up with Year Zero was just like a little inside joke to myself because I'd written this book called Year One long before. And I called the prologue of the book Year Zero because if people read the book, they'll understand that the prologue is about the moment when the aliens first discovered human music. And the point, of course, is that the aliens love our music. And that happens in what they call Year Zero, which to us is 1977. So I just gave the prologue the name Year Zero. And then that ended up kind of like taking on a life of its own. And I kind of liked it. And my editor liked it. We ended up calling the book that. But there is absolutely no connection between this book, Year Zero, and my book, Year One, other than that the names are obviously closely related. Now, I'm focusing very much from a writing standpoint on the movie stuff right now. And that's hopefully going to have me very busy for quite a while here. And, you know, once that's over, I am almost certainly going to turn full attention to writing my next novel. And there's at least a 50-50 chance that it will be a sequel to this one. Because there's many, many loose ends that are not tied up. And I really like the characters and I like a lot of elements of the premise. But I'm going to keep writing fiction. And I am definitely going to keep writing in this kind of like comedic but with a commentary type of vein.
So, Rob, I understand you have some more news about Year Zero in terms of its availability online.
I do. So as we speak right now, and for at least the next several days, I'd say going, you know, probably well into October 2013, in case some people are listening to this in the distant future, Random House has rolled out a really intriguing and aggressive pricing promotion. And the ebook for Year Zero in the United States only, unfortunately, although I hear there are some international places on Kindle, but I'm not sure exactly where. But at least in the United States, the Year Zero ebook is 99 cents. And I think it's really cool that Random House is experimenting with pricing. They just came out with the paperback a few months ago, and I believe the list price on that is like $15. So and I think that they're doing this to basically drive awareness of the book in the run-up to the holiday season or something like that. But I think it's really cool that they're experimenting with this, and it de-risks the prospect of buying a book by a new author, hopefully, by a significant degree. And I'm hoping a lot of people will read it as a result of that. I will barely make any money personally off of books, ebooks that sell for 99 cents. But my motivation in writing this and has always been to just reach as many people as possible. Rather that nobody's really gets rich writing science fiction. So my goal is to reach as many people as possible. And hopefully at 99 cents, more people will take a chance and more people will read it. And, you know, hopefully more people will be entertained by it.
Well, all the best with all of those initiatives, Rob. And thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you kindly. It was a lot of fun being here.
Rob Reed is a writer and entrepreneur and the author of Year Zero, perhaps soon to be a major motion picture in a theater near you. If you like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series or Dirk Gently books by Douglas Adams,
You'll probably enjoy Year Zero, especially if you're an IP lawyer. For further information on Rob Reed, his book Year Zero, the ABA Landslide review of his book, and Rob's TED Talk on copyright math, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.